kid, I think you got him. Good shot, kid, I think you got him.
Hello, Colin. Can you hear me okay?
Lee, I can hear you perfectly. Can you hear me?
Yep, looks good. Looks like the recording's all going as well, which is a nice start.
Good stuff. Glad to hear it.
Right, so how are things going today then, Colin?
Not bad so far. It's been busy, but yeah, I've managed to put aside some time, and so hopefully we can get into some reminiscing about all things audio and GTA and DMA design.
Yeah, I really appreciate that, Colin. And as you know, and my listeners know, this is a really big interview for me because I think GTA was one of the first games that really made me conscious that I loved games. Like, way back when I was about 7 years old, I was far too young for it.
See, everybody I speak to who played GTA, they all say, oh yeah, I played it when I was like seven or like nine or something. I'm like, where were your parents? It had an 18 certificate on it for a reason.
You see, the trouble with me was that I had a brother who was 7 years older and he would always let me in on these things.
Yeah, I had that too. So yeah, I know exactly what you mean.
I don't feel too corrupted by it though.
Glad to hear it. Been getting mixed reports.
Well, I thought we'd start off with like going right back to the start of the story. And this is something that's been covered a lot. But I know that you were one of the key, absolutely key people in getting the radio stations on the table and in discussing them and in convincing higher ups that it'd be a good idea. So after over a decade of like purely electronic chip tunes, what convinced you that GTA's approach would be an important evolution? And how did you convince others?
Oh, to be fair, I wasn't thinking of it like that. I wasn't thinking like, oh, this is going to be an important evolution for the medium of video game music. For me, it was purely a problem that I needed to solve as a person who was in charge of audio. So the problem that we had was GTA was essentially a 2D game, and that was kind of mid-90s, and things were moving to 3D. So it didn't look great when you looked at it in screenshots in magazines, which was by far and away the preliminary way that people got their information about games at that time. And worse still, we were moving on to CD. So we had this situation where the decision had been taken that GTA was going to go out as a CD-ROM game. And of course, CD-ROMs have a megabyte limit of, well, I think originally it was 650 and then they pushed it to like 720 or something like that. And the game just was never going to take up that amount of space. The graphics, the code, all of that, you could probably have fit it on a few floppy disks if you tried hard enough. So we had this, it was really a marketing problem more than anything, which was how do we as a studio convince people that this game is worth their money when Tomb Raider's coming out, Wipeout, you know, people were playing Wipeout and things like that. So that was the point where I saw an opportunity to help with the marketing of the game, which is there were all these other games moving on to CD-ROM. Some of them had really good CD soundtracks. They sounded fantastic. And so part of me was just like, okay, well, if we do that, they were getting lots of good press because of the quality of the sound. It was novel at that time, right? The idea of CD quality music in a video game was still new. Very few people had heard of it, and some people couldn't even conceive that is that even possible, you know? So I pushed that and said, well, if you're not going to be using the CD for anything else, would it be okay if we used it? And I was kind of given the green light to say, yeah, you know, if you can use it, great. But only because nobody else knew what to do with it. It wasn't like everybody thought, oh, this is a brilliant idea. Go ahead and let's use it as a showcase for audio. It was just nobody else wanted it, so it was left over. So that was the idea. We were going to transition over, and because it had originally it was going to be synth-based, it was going to be MIDI. So we were going to have a set of samples in there, and we were going to trigger those samples with MIDI or some kind of code that would trigger it. And it was in the process of writing the music that we came up with this idea of radio stations. And I've told this story before, but for anybody who hasn't heard it, Craig Connor, who was working on the audio at that time, so I'd hired Craig to come in and do music. We'd hired three musicians at that time, because DMA Design was growing. Craig was one of the guys who I'd hired. He'd really impressed me. His demo tape and everything he said was fantastic. And he came in, started working on GTA, and I just asked him to write a bunch of tunes, just little snippets, sketches, as we called them, little sketches of tunes of the kind of thing that might work in the game, because we didn't know. At that point, it was still a case of, what do we think would work? We weren't thinking radio stations. We were just thinking, what kind of music's going to work for us? So Craig was writing all these sketches, and I went round to his desk to review them one day, and he was playing with them, and they were great. They were all really good, and it just felt like a waste. Like, oh my goodness, you're going to end up with all these cool little tunes that we're not going to be able to do anything with, and obviously you can keep them and use them in other projects, because we weren't just working on GTA. We had a team that were working on maybe 8 games at that point, so we'd have used them somewhere else. But it was at that point when he was letting me hear them, and I was like, because all the tracks he did, they all had a certain style to them. He'd written some that were kind of rockier, some that were pop, some that were dance, techno, club, whatever. And when he let me hear them, they sounded kind of like radio stations. It was almost like you were listening to these tiny little radio stations. And that, I think, not consciously, but just subliminally, triggered me to say, these are fantastic. If only we could find some way of, it'd be really cool if we could get a kind of radio station in the game that could play all these bits of music. And I clearly remember his face. It was as I said that, without thinking anything about it, just like, oh, yeah, it'd be cool if we could get radio stations in it. Craig looked at me and his eyes kind of lit up. And me seeing Craig react to that made me pause and go, that might work. we might be onto something there. So that was the spark, because as I've said before, we never went into GTA expecting to do what we did with the audio. That came along for the ride, it fell out of the creative process. So that was the genesis of how we came onto it. But like I say, we weren't thinking about it from a oh, let's revolutionize the video game music industry or anything like that. It was just a case of how can we use audio to deliver the best game we possibly can for players? Because that's your job as an audio person working on a game. Your job isn't to make great audio. It's not to advance the art of it's not to advance the art of video game music. Occasionally, opportunities come up to do that, and you take them when they present themselves, for sure. But that's not your purpose. Your purpose is there to make the game the best it can possibly be, so that the people who play it have the best time playing it and get the most enjoyment from it. So you're using audio to entertain players the same way that artists are using the visual medium, coders are using their functions and all that sort of thing. So that's where it came from. It was a pure attempt to do our job, really, is all it came from.
Mm-hmm. But it must have turned into a really inspiring thing, because it's interesting to hear you talk about how it started with problem solving, but it clearly turned into such a creative thing for everyone who was involved. And you can hear that in the prime example of your musical work in the first Grand Theft Auto is Radio 76, the Funk FM one, which I think you basically wrote all of the music for that one.
Thanks. Yeah, that was me. Yeah.
And it's the creativity really is incredible, because I'm a musician too, and I get really into these conceptual things, and I've done a few like conceptual fake band stuff myself, where it's all me but kind of coming up with fake members and stuff. And you've got that going on the Funk channel as just one example, with the Stylus Exodus band, who later show up in GTA 2. So I wondered, like, how in depth you got into creating this band, because there's a real sound there, like whether you decided on individual members and things like that with individual personalities.
Oh, that's I can't honestly remember. I don't think we went into it in that much depth. I'd love to say that we did, but I don't think we did. And most of that was because I don't think we were that good at that time. If I was doing it now, I might take that approach, because certainly subsequently, after leaving DMA and setting up Denki, my own studio with some of the ex-DMA people I worked with, Gary Penn, he's a big champion of essentially when you're creating audio for a game, you don't just think of it in terms of what music or what musical style are we going to do. He talks about, let's form a band for the game. So when we did Quarrel, for example, back in about 2008, 2009, Jed Grimes he was in Danny Wilson, currently he's in Simple Minds, bass player for Simple Minds just now. He wrote the music for that, and that was a conversation I remember him having with Gary Penn, which is like, okay, it's going to be Latin music we're doing. We're going to be doing salsa and calypso and all these kind of things. But they built a band. They literally had, okay, this guy, and had personalities written out for the players, you know, that sort of thing. But no, we didn't. Unfortunately, we didn't do it. It didn't take it to that extreme. But it's probably that. We certainly had the idea of doing fake bands that was conscious. And that came about, I think, that I was majorly inspired by the likes of Spinal Tap, for example. So Spinal Tap was a big influence on me. And that idea of creating a fake thing and then portraying it as if it's real really appealed to me. And lots of other people in DMA, it was that was the kind of geeks we were. That was the stuff we enjoyed. So no, sorry, I can't honestly, hand on heart, say that we went into that level of detail of forming a band and having the players. But we certainly conceptualized, you know, this kind of track is going to have this kind of sound. We tended to take archetypes of really famous songs that we liked in that genre, because very often we were writing in genres we didn't know that well. Like I love funk, but I wouldn't say I'm a funk aficionado by any stretch. I know the big tracks, but if you asked me much about it, if you scratch the surface, you'd find out I don't know that much. But the research part of it, we all really enjoyed digging into the genre, picking out the tracks that inspired us and made us go, oh yeah, that quintessentially, that track is that says funk to us. So, and we'd often take, I don't know, maybe three or four different tracks, and we'd like a verse from this and a chorus from that, and oh, the way the intro starts on that, we'd bring all those together and kind of mash them up. And then obviously just the process of it bleeding through you as individuals, you instantly, it takes on a style of itself. So yeah, it was not that deliberate, but it was going in that direction.
And if not full on fake members, you did have a lot of amazing real life musicians helping you with that stuff. And I wanted to get into some of that a little bit soon. But one thing that I haven't seen asked about at all is to what extent you might have been playing with and using sample CDs and things like that, because I'm not sure. And it sounds to me like some of that stuff might have been going on the Funk FM stuff, and perhaps in like some of the little vocal stings and some of the female vocals. And if not, who is that? Because she's amazing.
Yeah, indeed. Like who is the vocalist that did all that? No, so that's interesting. You should definitely, if you get a chance, on Twitter there's a user called Dusty and Blue who I chat to quite frequently about the sort of making of GTA. He's really big into his sort of the audio side of the GTA franchise, and he was asking exactly that, like, where did this sound come from, where did that sound, because a lot of people have pointed out over the years, they've said, oh, that sound, you know, why did GTA copy the track that's in this other game? I can't remember the ones, but because we were all using the same sample CDs at the same time, there was one company in the UK that dominated that point, which was Time and Space, and they had a set of sample CDs called the Zero G Collection, and you can find them online. I think they've all been uploaded now. But if you listen through those, you'll find a lot of the, not just on my tracks, because certainly the vocal snippets, most of them are out of there. There's a few that I did in order to kind of fill spaces and things, but not many. It's mostly sample CDs, but certainly a lot of the loops, drum loops, bass loops, stuff like that Craig used on other tracks, they're off of, if not those CDs, then some of the other ones that we had around. There weren't that many sample CDs at that time. It was quite early in the that genre. I mean, you didn't have enough RAM to load a lot of the samples, even if you'd wanted to sample them. So it was only because we shifted on to using hard disk recording that gave us the ability to take a lot of these samples, mix them together. So yeah, sample CDs certainly played their part in the GTA story, that's for sure.
Yeah, and I think it helps lend to, and I was pointing this out to my girlfriend last night while we were both listening to the soundtrack, this really American feeling to the whole radio stations, which is, of course, is appropriate to the game being set in America. But is that part of how you achieve that kind of American sound?
You know, I'm not, to this day, I'm not sure that we achieved an American sound, because like when we did that, I'm not sure any of us had been to America, quite honestly. So we didn't know what American radio sounded like. I do remember getting some of the guys who were working at BMG Interactive, who was the publisher that we originally were working with before Take-Two got involved. I remember asking them if they could send us some just cassettes. That's how long ago we're talking about. Actually, could they send us some cassettes of just radio in the US so that we could hear what the jingle sounded like, what the DJs sounded like? Because we had no idea. I mean, it was all pre-internet. I mean, you had the internet, but nothing like that. So trying to get access to that stuff was really hard, which meant our references were all what we could get on movies and things like that. It was, so I think somebody who talked to me before was saying it was really interesting because the movies kind of created a fake version of American culture, and then GTA reflected that fake version of American culture from the movies, filtered it back into the culture of GTA, which has then pushed it back, and it's become this kind of amorphous blob of mixed culture. But yeah, I don't know that we actually got an American sound. If we did, it was more by accident and good fortune than any, you know, real studious attempt to do it, I think. Probably a lot of our influences are American. Certainly mine are.
Yeah, that's interesting. Maybe that's my bias, being British as well and not being particularly proficient with American radio either. But another bias of mine is because I'm Forefront, a bass player, and we've talked about this a little bit in messages. I cannot move on from the funk stuff without talking about Brian Socia, who you mentioned was the bass player on the Stylus Exodus stuff. Just some of the best bass playing I've ever heard. So where did that come from? Did you just let him rip?
Pretty much, yeah. So Brian, one of the guys who worked at DMA, I'm a huge fan of the band Rush. It's quite fashionable now, but at that time it was highly unfashionable. So there was a little kind of clique of us at DMA Design who would admit to being Rush fans. I was one of them. And this guy, Andy White, his brother was Brian Socia. So it was a family connection, you know, friend and family connection. And Brian was a huge Rush fan as well. So myself, I was a guitar player, Andy was a drummer, and Brian was a bass player. So we just got together, started jamming Rush tracks. And it was when I was doing that, I noticed, like, this guy's amazing. Such a great bass player. Totally, totally wasted. So obviously when the opportunity came up to record some stuff and I needed a bass player, I didn't even hesitate. It was a case of, do you want to come in and play bass? And then, like, Brian, although he played a lot of Rush, he was a huge sort of Jaco Pastorius fan. He was big into jazz and funk and all that kind of stuff. So I let him hear the track, and I remember sort of saying, right, here's the structure of the track. I sent him a tape with the basic sort of skeleton of the track, and then just said, right, go for it, you know, do your thing. So he came back, and then we did a session where he came into the studio and we kind of sat down and he just jammed it. Because Brian, typical musician, he often didn't like work the whole thing out. He kind of got some ideas and then he'd wing it as he went through. I have immense respect for people who can do that, because I am no improviser, so I don't even try to do stuff like that. But yeah, he came in the studio and we ran the track. I think we probably did about 3 or 4 takes, and then I just comped together from his takes. There were some bits that I just thought, oh, that's amazing. So I put together this super take from the takes we did. And I think there's a bit in the middle that's in 5/4, I think. I do remember trying to sneak some prog references in there, because obviously progressive rock, right? We were big prog rock fans, and Brian and I were huge into it, and we're like, all right, can we sneak any prog stuff in? So I think we managed to get a few Rush riffs. Snuck, I think it was a Jethro Tull one we snuck in as well. So it's fun. But yeah, that's where that came from. And then the second, when we did it on GTA 2, he came in to do the bass on Stylus Exodus again. And by that time, he was playing fretless. So that whole second, that whole Stylus Exodus Toucan Pie track is all done on a fretless bass. And it's astonishing. To this day, like you say, some of the best bass playing I've ever heard. Amazing track, amazing player. So just lucky to get the chance to work on.
Yeah, it truly is amazing. And you worked with a lot of like really talented people throughout the soundtracks to both GTA 1 and 2. And to not take up too much of your time, I'll try and roll up a couple of questions into one. Because one of your key tracks as well from the original soundtrack is Sticky Fingers. You came across a great vocal performance by Paul Mackey, who then went on to do loads more work with GTA. And another key track of yours, of course, is the ballad of Chaplips Calhoun, which you almost can't get away from, it seems, in interviews. And that has a really fascinating story behind it, where you was playing with some players from a local guitar shop or music shop, if I'm not wrong.
Yeah, totally. Well, the sound of that track, the sound of GTA, of the country channel, was pretty much, I wrote the track, Brian Baglow, who was the sort of PR and kind of writer, he did a lot of mission scripts and things for GTA, he was writing, I asked him if he would do lyrics for it, and boy did he. The men found their women scary, cause they were so big and hairy, they thought of dynamite, steal them men. So he did the lyrics, I did the music, and then I actually went down to, so we were buying a lot of equipment for the studio, for DMA studio at that point, and I knew the guys in the local music shop, Rainbow Music in Dundee. I knew them really well, and I'd often, when I was in getting something, I'd say, do you know anybody that plays kazoo, we need somebody to do something, and they would inevitably know somebody in the local area, because this was, again, it's a different world now, but back then, if you needed somebody, if you needed a player, you couldn't just go on a message board and find somebody. You had to know someone who knew someone. So I would go there and ask what they knew. And one day I went in and said, I need a pedal steel player, because I'm doing a country track and I need somebody to play pedal steel. And Chris Mara, who was working in the shop at the time, he's like, I play pedal steel. I'm like, fantastic, that's great, let's get this organized. And he said, I could bring a banjo as well, I could play banjo. I'm like, fantastic. And he's like, do you want me to bring a mouth organ? Bring it all. So he turned up, that track is pretty much Chris Mara playing all the cool bits, and then Mike James, who was also working at Rainbow Music at the time, he played violin on it. And then the rest of it is me and John Gurney playing drums. And then, of course, the vocal performance from Drew Lard. Drew was a guy that still plays around Dundee in the pubs. He's got a band called Drew Lard and the Buzzards. And I used to go to a bar called Chambers Bar every Sunday to see this band play, because they were fantastic, just an amazing amazing pub band, Drew's voice. John Ford was playing guitar. Phenomenal player. That was the thing that amazed me when I moved to Dundee, was how good the music scene was. Like, the players in Dundee were just incredible. I'd come from Edinburgh, and the scene there wasn't anywhere near as good. You turn up in a pub in Dundee and the quality of players was just like professional. You know, I've paid to see worse bands. So that was pretty much how that all came together. A lot of it was just somebody knew a boy that knew a boy kind of thing.
Well, this was one of my favourite things about the whole thing, and reading other interviews with you, talking about how healthy it was, not just for the game, for the players, for the game industry, but for Dundee and for local players and things like that. It's really, really fascinating. But I definitely have a fair few non-musical questions, which GTA 2 is a good platform for that. But actually, just before I moved on from that, I did want to ask about how much you'd collaborate with some of the other primary musicians like Craig Connor and Grant Middleton, because I've heard you talk about how proud you are of that main theme. But as far as I know, that was a composition by another person, so I wondered how much collaboration was going on there.
That's a good question. I can't remember. Almost none, I think, because we had so much to do that we didn't really... We didn't really help each other out. It was our responsibility. Like, I was responsible for the funk channel. Craig was responsible for the dance channel. And it was a case of, it's your responsibility, it's my responsibility. So you just took responsibility and you didn't really have the opportunity, or I guess it just wasn't, we didn't really think of it like that. Other people were busy with their own tracks. It would have been an imposition to go and say, can you just help me with this track? That's not to say we didn't get other members to help out. So, for example, the keyboard part on The Move by Ghetto Fingers, which is like I think it's the first track on the funk channel on GTA. So that's got a fantastic keyboard part. So that was Stuart Ross, who was another one of the musicians. He wasn't working on GTA at that point, but he was working on Body Harvest. But he's an amazing multi-instrumentalist, and if I needed a keyboard part, I'd go to him and say, Stuart, can you fit something in there? And he'd sit down and like play something, and I'd go, yep, that's great. You know, off on to the next one. And Craig would do that as well, and so would Grant. So I think we would each work with other people within the department, because we're about six or seven of us at that point, but not all working on GTA, we were working across, because as I said, we had about eight different projects we were looking after at that point. So Grant, Craig and I didn't tend to work together. We very much worked on our own, but Grant, Craig and I would work with the other guys in the department if we needed stuff. That usually meant Stuart, because he was the most talented player in the department, if everybody knew that.
Well, one thing I haven't heard you guys talking about in other interviews really at all that I wanted to get into was that you did work on the sound effects for both games as well. And some of those, to me, and I know to other players, are absolutely iconic. So what's your process, or what back then, what was your process for sound effects?
So I hated doing sound effects, honestly, because my background was music. And I remember when I got stuck into to doing video games, suddenly there was this whole other category of sound I'd never really thought much of it before, which was sound effects, sound design. So I had to learn that as I was going. GTA, the process that we used for that was we kind of flung things in as we found them. So there was stuff that it all came off sample CDs. So gunshots and footsteps and all those kind of things. There was an emerging scene of sample CDs, studios that would release sample CDs and you could use them. So we had a lot of them. In fact, I think there's a bit of footage from that BBC program. They came up to DMA and they interviewed the GTA team. And on that bit of footage, you can actually see Grant Middleton showing off how the sound effect process work. So it was actually a huge CD changer with about, I can't remember, 400 CD slots, and it was linked to an Apple Mac that had a database, and you sort of typed in footsteps, and it would bring up all the potential footsteps, and you had to go and listen to them. You'd click the thing, and then it would load the CD and play the thing, and you go, no, that's not it, and go on to the next one. So you can see how that worked. Then Alan Walker, who was much more forensic in his sound design. He was much more sound design orientated than any of the rest of us, I think, in the department. So whereas the rest of us could do sound effects and sound design, but we didn't really love it, Alan really loved it. So once we put all the stuff in, we actually brought him in at the end and said, could you make that sound better, please? So he came in and started ripping all the sounds out and putting better ones in. And that was the basis of the main sounds. But then all the other bits that, I guess, are more recognisable now, like the pedestrian comments, the police radio, all of that stuff, we kind of had to figure that out from scratch because there wasn't a template that we could easily borrow it from. And mostly it was just trial and error. It was a case of, right, record some basic sounds like, hey, you, watch it, buddy, all that kind of thing.
Hey, watch it, buddy!
And then you'd stick them in the game and go, oh, that doesn't sound bad. Can we get some more? So we'd put some more in. And then once we thought, yeah, this is working, we'd build the system, get it working. And then it was a case of, right, we need content. So we need the actual samples that we're going to trigger for the finished version of the game. And I remember that was hard because it needed to sound like Americans mostly, and we had no Americans working at DMA at the time. So we just had to get people in and record, get them to put on American accents. So I think, again, if you go through my Twitter feed, you'll probably find it. I think I emailed something out because we're locked down and everything last year. I was up in the attic and dragging some boxes out, and I found a hard drive that still has some of the emails from the time that I was working at DMA. And I actually sent an email to the team saying, right, here's all the pedestrian comments and who said them. So there's a list on Twitter somewhere. If you look, you'll find a list of which members of the DMA team. And I think it was all the DMA team with the exception of Melissa Ripley, who was Gary Penn's partner. So she came in because we had no women either. It was that kind of industry back then. We weren't just short of Americans, we were short of women as well. Certainly women who were prepared to sit down and do a recording session with us.
So I can finally find out who's been calling me a dickwad since the late 90s.
You can, yeah, you definitely can. It's there, it's all documented.
That's amazing. And yeah, because sound effects and all that kind of thing are so important, and the radio stations in the first Grand Theft Auto are primarily musical. But in Grand Theft Auto 2, you had a real chance to open things up, and you started to include commercials, which were huge, a lot more like personality from the radio presenters and things like that. So when did ideas like this come to the table, and how involved were you in those?
So the idea for those was there right from the start. It was there from when we were doing GTA. And we tried to do it because if you listen to GTA, you'll hear like Head Radio's got some was it 69 to Deadfly, no, 89 to Deadfly 65, I can't remember what it is.
I can hear it in my head already, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So you know what I'm talking about. And that was, so going back to my previous point, we didn't have any Americans at DMA. By the time it got towards the end of the project, because the first problem was, how the hell are we going to record this much music in that amount of time with only these people? So that was a huge problem, and so our first headache was just how do we solve that? So we thought, as we were going through, like, oh, it'd be cool to put together actual stations where there's little jingles and adverts and DJs and stuff. But it was just purely a case of we ran out of time to do it. So all we had time to do on GTA 1 was, by the time we came to do that stuff right at the end, DMA had opened an American office in Boulder, Colorado. So, and Grant Middleton had gone to Boulder to look after the audio for that studio. So I used to speak to Grant and say, "Could any chance you could get some of your colleagues to do a recording session for us? Because we could really do some better American accents than we have if we're going to do anything more than just a little pedestrian, hey, watch it, buddy, you know, I'm walking here," and that kind of thing. So, so he was like, "Yeah, okay, I'll speak to them." And they agreed, bless them. So we got we sent them a script of like the the Fergus Butler show where it's like going all the way back there. That's the Ballad of Chaplin's Calhoun. So I sent them what I wanted them to say, along with an example of me saying it, so he could get the feel for it, and then he would use that as direction to get the performers to try and emulate it. And then they would send back the tapes. Or might have been DAT tapes at that time, actually. I don't think it would have been files. It would have been too big. And get them back and then listen through them and go, because he'd send sort of 5 or 6 different versions of each one, and we'd listen and go, "That's the one. That's what he needs." So Craig and I, by that point, it was mostly just Craig and I doing it, and we'd sit and go through them and pick out the ones we liked, and then try and compile it into something approaching a radio station. So the idea was there from GTA, but we just, it was too much to do in the time. We'd already, like, there was a lot to do on GTA. We were solving a lot of problems, and we were solving them from scratch. So we just had to accept, like, that's enough. But GTA 2, when that came around, we had a period beforehand where we were just, it was kind of spitballing ideas, and a lot of that, obviously GTA becomes a hit. But you're doing GTA, nobody cares, because, like, nobody's ever heard of it. GTA comes out, boom, it blows up, and everybody's suddenly like, "Great, so what are you going to do next?" Oh, God. So we've got to think of all these ideas that we can get people excited about. And one of those was to pick up on the stuff we wanted to do in the first one but never had the opportunity, was let's build actual radio stations. So let's get DJs, personalities, and script them, and start to try and become self-referential, talk about the actual places and the people in the world, to try and, again, just to try and stitch together this whole idea of living, breathing city, you know? I think even in the first game, I think the audio plays such a huge part in delivering that living, breathing city feel. Everybody talked about it, like, "Oh, it feels like a living, breathing city," but if you turn the sound off, it don't feel so living, breathing anymore, that's for sure.
Yeah, it's true.
Yeah, so that's where that came from. And in GTA 2, it was just a case of we decided to do it, and then it was a production resourcing issue. If we're going to do it, how do we do it? And fortunately, we were able to get Michael Keeler, who had written, you know, he was a writer, understood scripting and directing actors and things like that. So he came in and worked with us on the scripting for both the DJs and the adverts as well. So I remember having great fun with Mike, just going through and him throwing out ideas like, "Oh, we could do an advert about this and that," and going, "Yeah, that's too far. Let's dial it back a bit." Like, "Oh, that one's good. Let's go with it." So that was good fun. And then, again, Mike did a fantastic job. Just he really did define the template for what has gone on afterwards. You know, if you listen to GTA 3 and beyond, it's that times 10. They just took what Mike did and really took it to the next level, which is great, because as far as I'm concerned, that's exactly what we wanted to do. We didn't just want to create a good experience in GTA 2. We were literally trying to define the sound of this world as we went, in the knowledge that certainly after the first one blew up, it's like, yeah, this is going someplace. There's going to be more of these. So we wanted to make sure that people had something substantial to run with. And they did.
Mm-hmm. And GTA 2 was actually a really ambitious project in the audio, because you had a lot going on. You've opened things up with the commercials, like we've already talked about. You had this interesting mechanic with FM and AM radio switching between different qualities as you get closer to different buildings and areas. Really fascinating stuff. But one thing that I definitely wanted to dig into while I had you here was the unused prog station, which I think you saw I tweeted last night. Ridiculous FM, which you did eventually bring to fruition, I think something like
15 years late, yeah.
YTZ by Aori, if I'm pronouncing
that's right. Yeah, that's correct. Yeah.
Could you talk a little bit about the background of this and how it was something you wanted to include it, and so much so that you later had to do it 15 years later?
Yeah, it became an itch that I had to scratch, and it took me about 15 years to scratch it. It was literally just, like, as you'll realise, like, once you have the idea, we're going to put radio stations in the game, then it's a case of what radio stations are we going to do. And if you look back at the notes of all the stations we thought of on GTA 1, it was literally everything you could think of, from opera, jazz, talk radio, the phone and stuff. So that was all there. But you just, when you were figuring out, like, what's it going to take to do this? Like, trying to do a talk radio station was just like, oh my god, we just didn't have the resources. It was well beyond anything that we could do. Like, even when we had Mike working on scripts, the idea of getting him to do a script for an entire channel was just not going to work. So we basically put a pen through all the ones that just weren't going to be possible, and put them in the, we'll get to that if we get the chance, pile. And the prog rock, the regressive, playing regressive rock, Ridiculous FM was one of those. So again, just coming out of ideas, as I said earlier on, I'm a huge prog rock fan, and therefore I just wanted to put prog rock in the game for no other reason than I wanted to. But the best bit was I finally figured out a construction whereby I could justify doing it, which was, in the first game, we had the idea of the country and western channel that would only play one track, and it was the idea of this hick DJ that would play the same track round and round and round. So we'd established that as a joke. You know, that was a defined format for the joke. And then we were going to carry it on in the second one, which was to have another station that only played one track round and round and round. But this time, the joke would be, it was a 20-minute prog rock epic, so they only played one prog rock song. And I started doing it, and very quickly it went in the same pile as the opera and the talk channels. It was just a case of, it was just going to take me too long, because I'm not that good. I can write to that quality, but not with a gun to my head when you've got to finish by a certain day. And GTA 2 was done to a deadline, which was we had to have it out by the end of Take-Two's year end in 99. So yeah, and it couldn't slip, so we had to make some tough choices, and Ridiculous FM was one of those tough choices, unfortunately. But of course, with the advent of the internet, everybody can now hear what I would have done anyway, so you can decide for yourselves whether you were saved or not.
Well, you're not the only big prog rock fan. I am as well. So that was an absolute gem to find. And before we finish up today, I just wanted to check I'm not taking up too much of your time. I think I can roll things up into three last quick questions.
Sure, yeah. Uh-huh.
So one aspect of GTA 2 that I thought was really interesting and has never been revisited in Grand Theft Auto since was, and this was how you put it in an interview, was 5 minutes into the future. And it is kind of, it's slightly, ever so slightly set into the future, which Grand Theft Auto has never done before. How did this impact anything that you did? And were there any significant examples?
Right, so first off, five minutes into the future was not my creation. That was the design direction. I can't remember who came up with it, but certainly Colin McDonald or some of the guys that were leading the project, maybe Brian Lawson or someone, would have come up with that. Might even have been Dave Jones, I can't remember. Anyway, the direction came down to me, GTA 2, it's 5 minutes in the future, make it work. I'm like, okay. And so we took that and ran with it. It was a nightmare, quite frankly. And I know exactly why they've never done it since. Because you lose so much that you get, you don't even realize you're getting your design done for free when you're copying the real world, right? So when you're copying cars in the real world, you don't have to wonder how they work, where the lights are, what horn sounds like, any of that stuff, because you can just go and look. As soon as it's 5 minutes into the future, all of that is up for question. So, yeah, so it was really just, like, I remember very early on in the process of GTA 3 getting the design document from Les, because he'd taken control of the design at that point. And it's just like in big letters right at the start of the thing. This is not some geeky 5 minute into the future sci-fi nerd fest. This is contemporary now. And I remember reading that and thinking, oh, thank goodness we're going back to something contemporary that we can just look at and copy, rather than having to have endless debates and arguments about what should a 5 minutes into the future car look and sound and handle like. So yeah, I know exactly why GTA has never been back to the future since then. Although, interestingly, there is a game called Glitch Punk that's just come out, which looks like GTA 2. It's like a really posh, kind of nicely upgraded version of GTA 2. And they've gone for the cyberpunk design ethic. So it'd be interesting to talk to those guys, see if they had the same problems.
And it's interesting, actually, you should mention cyberpunk, because I've been playing a little bit of that lately and been thinking, yes, the radio stations thing still matters today and it's still influential, but there's no DJs. Or like, they only come in, like, once every 15 minutes to do the same repeated news report, and then it's, yeah.
Yeah, it's odd how the format of music changing and radio becoming so much on demand now, that if you launch GTA today, would it have radio stations in it? I don't know. Probably not, actually. It's a great conceit for the game as it was at that time, and now it's established. I think nobody would ever question it. It's become a feature that everybody expects and looks forward to. But if the game franchise was launching today, I'm not sure we'd do it. I don't know if it would have crossed our mind.
And as a big fan of the series, I mean, I have to be honest, like, I have felt that slightly diminished with each title, and it get kind of less funny each time and get less excited for the commercials and things like that.
Yeah, yeah. No, it's tough. I mean, I remember that's one of the reasons I stepped away from it, was because after I'd done two full projects and then, like, during the pre-production for three, and like, you, I could feel my love for this diminishing, and that I'd done what I was looking to do with it, and it was, we were going to be retreading the same ground over and over again, and I'm not good at that. I'm more of a pioneer than a farmer when it comes to audio, interactive audio and video game. I get excited about the new thing, and I tend to, if you ask me to do the same thing over and over, you'd be better asking somebody else, because I'll phone it in. So yeah, it's interesting you pick up on that as well, is that the magic diminishes, I think, as it goes on.
There's a tiny little bit of that coming in on GTA 2, in that there are a few licensed tracks in there.
Yeah, well, that was commercial pressure from outside. Like, we would have done all the tracks. We would have done all the tracks ourselves, or commissioned them from, like, local bands that we wanted to work with and things like that, if we'd had our chance. But there was always a tension between, like, Sam and his team at Rockstar. They had a big problem, which was they wanted to market the game, make the game as easy to market as possible, and bringing in bands from outside that already had audiences and commercial appeal really helped them to get coverage from magazines and websites and just more PR, basically. Whereas I was at the other extreme, which was, I was a purist. I was a case of, no, you know, GTA isn't it's not the real world. It's a parallel world. There shouldn't be shared tracks. Like, if it'd been up to me, for example, and I heartily understand that most GTA fans would hate this, but if it had been me, if I'd been doing Vice City and had complete editorial control, there wouldn't have been any real bands in there, because the because as far as I'm concerned, those bands never existed in the GTA universe. There would be twisted pastiches of them, so you'd have somebody that sounded like Phil Collins, but it wouldn't be Phil Collins. And that's the way that I would have taken it. But I completely get why Sam and Terry and those guys didn't want to pursue that, because they had a more immediate problem, which was, how do we make sure that this game sells lots of copies?
I feel like we've covered GTA pretty nicely, as well as we can in the time. I think we could go on for a long, long time about it, but in the time available. And
if you let me, I'll talk about it forever.
And I easily could myself. But one thing that I definitely can't end this interview without bringing up, and it's actually on a completely different track, and it's only while I've got you here, is that I am a gigantic fan of Crackdown.
Oh, okay. Yeah,
so
yeah.
I kind of can't let you go away without bringing that up, because me and my brother were absolutely obsessed with that when it was first released. So just could you talk a little bit about the project and your involvement in it?
Sure. Yeah, well, Crackdown's an interesting one, and it's good you bring it up, I think, because in some regards, Crackdown for me was the culmination of the GTA radio idea. In that, like, I left during GTA 3, so the stuff that you hear in GTA 3 was mostly the audio team that I'd hired before GTA 1. That was them. They went and built that and did an amazing job with it. But I was off by that point doing other stuff, and then Dave Jones got in touch saying he wanted to do this game called Crackdown, and when he explained it to me, I was like, that sounds like GTA 2 in 3D. And he's like, yeah, don't say that so loud. So he said, would you come and sort of help out with the audio? And I was like, yeah, of course, because I really enjoy working with Dave. That's one of that's another reason that I left DMA when I did, was Dave Jones had left and moved on to other things at that point. And I enjoyed working with Dave. He's a real visionary, proper pioneer. If you hang around with Dave, exciting things, exciting projects pop up, and he's always supportive. Like when I came up with a crazy idea, like let's build our own radio stations into this game, he was crazy enough not only to say yeah, let's do it, but give me the money to go and buy all the equipment and do everything. So as soon as he said, do you want to come and do Crackdown, I was like, yeah, sounds great. So that was good fun. It was quite different from GTA in that they were working with Microsoft, and Microsoft were pouring a lot of money into it, so we had the budget to do really cool stuff. And one of the coolest things that we got to do with that was we had our own music supervisors at Microsoft who would go and find us tracks from all over the world. So the idea was we weren't going to record our own tracks, because we didn't want to write the music in-house ourselves, because the styles of music that we wanted were so outside of our wheelhouse that it would have been a plastic facsimile of what we were looking to do. Because they had these gangs that they wanted to represent, and these gangs were very much based on some cultural quarters of the world. So it's like a Mexican gang, Japanese gang, a few others. So we wanted music that was authentically that kind of thing. So we worked with Microsoft. They went and found the tracks, sent us them. We'd listen, and then we'd commission the tracks. So, yeah, that was much, much more of a kind of evolution of the idea of radio stations and game. But the thing that didn't quite work was it didn't have that kind of irreverent humor that GTA had. So you couldn't fall back on that for the DJs and whatnot. It was much more serious. You were playing the cops, and that always caused problems, because from a design perspective, like right back on GTA, we'd quickly discovered that we shouldn't play the cops, because it's not as much fun as playing the robber. So Crackdown had its own problems. It was a difficult birthing process for Crackdown. But it came together in the end, and as you say, and obviously you found out yourself, there are a lot of people who absolutely love it, and I'm very pleased that that is the case. But it's in the lineage of games that I've done, that you can trace a direct link between GTA 1 and Crackdown.
Yeah, it definitely felt like a spiritual sequel to me.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad we could get that in there, and thank you for this, Colin. It's been absolutely fantastic.
No, fantastic. I'm glad we had the opportunity to chat, and hopefully we can do it again sometime.
Absolutely, yeah. I'm sure we've got lots more that we can talk about.
That's great. All right, good to speak to you, Lee.
Bye for now, Colin. Tell, speeding all around. An AK-47 got the power and it's bound to move any mother that gets in the way. Just another power machine on the freeway. Father with me as my MC homeboy. Knowing the rules ain't part of his program. Finding the right way around this map might be pretty hard cause he's fucked on crack. Jeep, Grand Theft Auto. You gotta make a mark and move where you want to. Deep, that determination to steal what you can and run from the nation. Hey, hey, what do you say? We automated secret to speed from our getaway. Take it to the edge, there's nowhere to hide and call up the boy. Let's go for the joyride. Let's go for the joyride. Violence from the police, and what my dad used to say, but now he's deceased. He got caught in a jam, threw in the can when the cops in Brooklyn said he'd kill another man. Cheap knowledge was my main game, to figure out the law, to figure out the frame. Just when I thought I knew justice, a cop on me said, you've just been busted. Don't fuck with me. Dick what?